up, shoo-wop, ooh. Ooh, shoo-wop, shoo-wop, ooh.
Welcome to the Kindness Collective podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Harrington, where each week I'll be interviewing game changers who are up to good things in the world, supporting us with health and wellness resources, and ultimately how to live your kindest life. Let's get started. Hello, everybody. This is Patrick Harrington, and welcome to the Kindness Collective podcast. I'm here today with Andrew Frazier, friend, mentor, student, teacher, colleague. Warrior.
Soul brother.
Soul brother. Oh, really excited for this conversation. Andrew and I have been kind of orbiting each other's self over the course of the last maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah. And welcome, Andrew. Happy to have you here.
Thank you, man. Glad to share space with you again.
Yeah. So what you can expect from today is we're going to really look at yoga in relationship to relationship, intimacy, yoga over the course of one's life and the journey of it. And some interesting paradoxes around some of Andrew's activities that I think you're really going to like. So stay tuned for those. Andrew, let's start off with a little bit about you. Where are you from?
I'm actually a native Coloradan.
What?
Yeah.
Fist pound.
Yeah. Grew up in Littleton, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Awesome. So what high school is that?
Columbine High School.
Columbine High School. I knew that now. Thanks. It's all flooding back.
Yeah. Class of 2000.
Boom. That was an eventful thing. Wow. What do I say? That was amazing.
Yeah.
Huh. Life-changing.
Pivotal.
Pivotal.
To be sure. 1999 was a major turning point in my life.
And what grade were you in at that point?
I was a junior at school at the time that the shooting took place.
Hmm. Blessings.
Thank you.
Yeah. And so you graduated from Columbine?
Correct.
The year after?
Yeah, finished out my senior year in Littleton and then packed up to Durango, Colorado for the next 4 years, where I went down to college at Fort Lewis.
Oh, love Fort Lewis.
Yeah, as did I, and really went, one, to distance myself from a lot of the anchored memories and energy that still hovered around Littleton and the surrounding communities.
Mm.
But to go chase the mountains and the fresh air, because I'm a Boy Scout at heart, and I, having toured a number of different colleges, really saw the opportunity that was available not just on that campus, but in its periphery, in the La Plata and San Juan Mountains, where I could ski, snowboard, rock climb, mountain bike, go paddle the river, and so much more. And so it was just a playground for that chapter of my life.
And once in a while, attend a class.
Got better grades in college than I did in high school.
Wow.
Half the battle is just showing up.
Yeah, that is.
But I did intentionally structure my class schedule such that I would get out of bed early in the morning and go to like the 6:40 a.m. classes.
Right.
They had some of these early offerings. And I was done by 8:40 or 9 a.m. each day.
Yeah.
And only a 20-minute drive from the local ski resort, Purgatory. So I was hitting the slopes 4 to 5 days a week and still getting my homework done. The challenge was just getting to bed on time, you know, when it was like pint night Tuesdays.
Of course.
And still waking up to make it happen the next morning.
Oh, I can feel it. I can feel the vibe up there. What a great town. I went to Fort Lewis for my freshman year. And I just knew that there were more girls at CU Boulder. I just knew there was. And that had me transfer. But when I look back on it, I know that that was one of those pivotal moments that shaped my life going forward, because Fort Lewis was such a intimate little community, and the college up on the Mesa and the people that stayed, the sophomores and above, I noticed that they kept their distance from the freshmen. because so many of us left, that making relationship in that way, you know, they kind of waited, it seemed like, until you were in the sophomore class, and they're like, okay, it's safe.
Yeah.
Safe to commit to you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were small communities, and it was interesting too, because from my experience, that a lot of people actually galvanized more around the mountain-oriented sports.
Mm-hmm.
And while we did have college teams, basketball, soccer, football, and the like, they weren't as predominant as they would be at a university such as CSU or CU.
For sure.
And so it was funny because years ago I was visiting cousins in Columbus, Ohio, and we went to see a Buckeyes game. And at the Buckeyes Stadium in Columbus, I could be misquoting, but I think it packs in 90,000 fans or something amazing. And as we walked through town from their place to the stadium, everyone in town is wearing red shirts and hyped about the game. And my cousins asked me, was it like this at your college too? I said, no, in fact, the bleachers were small. You might see, 60 people in attendance at a Fort Lewis Skyhawks football game on a Saturday. And especially if there was snow or snow or sunshine, most people were out chasing that as opposed to sitting on the bench, just watching the action on the field.
Yeah.
So different priorities.
Totally different priorities. That's great. I love that you did that and that you got to experience the full on, natural world that college is. I imagine that was, healing after the experience of high school and just even the just being smaller than the mountain, the river. Can you talk a little bit about that process of being in nature after what you went through in high school?
Absolutely. Remaining in Littleton during my senior year of high school was really tough because at the time the Columbine shooting was, pretty groundbreaking, and we hadn't seen something of that scale in the United States or most parts of the world. And so the energy and the media cloud that hung over that for the year after was really challenging to navigate, in the sense that we couldn't really have a normal day at school because we'd have to kind of push our way through news cameras on the sidewalks at the other side of the street just to get to class and to try to return to a sense of normalcy. So I had a pretty visceral urge to get away from that and the incessant reminder that things aren't normal anymore.
Yeah.
And I also knew that the most common path for most of my classmates was to select one of the local big universities such as CU in Boulder, CSU in Fort Collins. And with that, I had a reticence to follow that path also because I had a little aversion to like the Greek society. Mm-hmm. And some of the hierarchical structures that come with that, the social silos in which some people belong and others don't. And that was part of my observation at Columbine that had caused the division, caused this amount of pain for young men who in turn inflicted upon others, was a feeling of not belonging. And so I was really reluctant to go and carry on with my same graduating class to just another environment where that same social hierarchy was reinforced. And thus the mountains really called to me as an escape, a geographic relocation away from most of these people and these memories, but also a chance to literally breathe fresh air and spend a lot of time in the wild. And so during that time, it was massively healing for me to not only curate a brand new personal community far from home, but to begin to redefine myself in that space and also in relation to this much bigger environment. And so I really, at that time, cut my teeth on rock climbing and mountaineering. And with all the big peaks in that area, I climbed my first 14er, I think my freshman year of college, and it became a fast addiction where almost weekly after that, I was in search of the next peak. Because what happened every time that I climbed a mountain, if I back up a moment, while living on campus, if you recall, it sits on a mesa overlooking the town of Durango, and then you've got this gorgeous vista of the La Plata Mountains in the distance. From my freshman dorm room, looking out the window, I could see these these peaks that were just calling to me. And I always thought in the mornings waking up, what would it be like to stand on that mountain and look back this direction? So once I had done that and I climbed this silver peak, not only did I have the accomplishment of looking back at the town of Durango, but I now saw six new mountains that I never could perceive from that last locale. And so each time it inspired me to stand atop a new peak that I did not know about a week before. And so there was this, it was almost as though more and more neural pathways were being built in my brain because I was starting to map a much larger sense of the world. Each time I stood on top of a new mountain and I looked down, whether at the town below and I could see the way that the streets intersected and how that bike path led back to my house and then connected the campus, or if I was navigating a topographical map, standing on top of a high summit and then seeing these large panoramas around me, I was having, I was crafting a new sense of myself in relation to a much bigger world. Whereas formerly for my high school years, I was living in a suburban bubble and one that was very much painted or tainted by a very dark experience in 1999. So there was massive healing and so much permission given to venture out into this uncharted territory and to start having a sense of relationship to something so much bigger that offered opportunity and expansive space to breathe and not just be confined or defined by a couple of these factors that I had related to for so many years.
Wow. Yes. Well said. Amazing. Let's see. I was doing a keg stand while you were looking back at the dorm and smoking weed for the first time. And so I love hearing that version of your freshman year and what occurred for you. And I wonder in the relationship to 1999 and your relationship to seeking, whether it was conscious or unconscious, healing. Today I had the experience of somebody sharing that they, you know, were given a diagnosis of something that they hadn't expected. And my off-the-cuff reaction was, congratulations. And I kind of caught myself. I was like, wow, congratulations. Interesting. Let's see how that lands. And she said, thank you. And we had time to talk about that and unpack it a bit. And that all kind of started when I realized, as people in my life were getting divorced, I would say congratulations, because a pattern disrupt occurred. Something wasn't working. It brought something to a head such that the pattern became really obvious, and then a decision was made. And without that pattern disrupt, the pattern might have continued, right? Or something. And when I look back at my life, the hardest times have led me to be the most interesting parts of myself. And so when I think about how comfortable I was through high school, that when I went to college, I sought the freedom of things that were new because I was away from home and stuff like that. But what I hear you saying is maybe there was something in the experience that you had in 99 that drove you to seek perspective in a way that that I wasn't driven to.
Yeah. And I don't want to gloss over the fact that I was also taking keg stands and bong hits. So I was no saint sleeping in a bed of pine needles every night.
Sure.
I just found the balance between how many beers I could throw back on a Tuesday night, still get to class, and then make it for, you know, first laps at purgatory all in 24 hours.
For sure. Amen. Yeah. Well, there's a book there
for
freshman orientation.
That's right. You know, I too congratulate people when they announce divorces or other things that have come crashing down for that same purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly what was occurring has led to this.
Yeah.
Let's celebrate the next step.
Yeah.
Even acknowledging the healing that still needs to take place. Yeah. When I think back on my takeaways from 99, I was clearly impacted by the death of classmates, friends, and teachers near to me. You know, neighbors who lived only two doors down no longer lived two doors down. Mm-hmm. And with that came a sense of urgency, because it was a real, like, talk about a pattern disruption. It's easy, particularly as a high schooler, to have a myopic and egocentric view of the world, the sense of invincibility and, you know, life will go on forever and there's nothing threatening, particularly in middle-class white suburbia. And yet that event let me know that despite my best intentions or total ignorance, the lights could go out any day, as they did with some really well-intended kids who were on a straight, narrow path for college and great, you know, Air Force Academy and beyond. So that compelled me to get busy living, as I frequently say. And for me, that was a lot of kinesthetic, tactile, and experiential living, in the sense of not just avidly reading books, but seeing a mountain and not being content to take a photo of it, but wanting to become intimate with it and scale that serpentine edge and know what it's like to experience that that atmosphere. So that one compelled me to just get out and savor and touch and explore and experience as much as I could in the form of many of these sports. Those also came with inherent risk, whether as I progressed in my skill set in rock climbing, in backcountry snowboarding, in mountain climbing, I would find myself oftentimes in pretty dicey situations that could result consequently in my death if I weren't paying attention. But what was offered inside of each of those was a sense of agency and control over my experience that I did not have years ago. Because I was going about my life just checking regular boxes and with an air of nonchalance and maybe even apathy. And then suddenly, in a day, in a matter of, you know, gunshots and explosions, it became clear to me that this life is not always under my control. And so I felt a very strong loss of power, control, and agency, and literally ran for my life from a menacing threat. Whereas in the mountain environment, I could actually go directly in the pursuit of dangerous, heightened states of sensation and feel a sense of agency and control, because I was the one at the helm.
You were choosing.
I was choosing it. Yeah. And it's sometimes said that, you know, survivors of trauma will engage in that kind of behavior where they seek to recreate similar experiences to their previous trauma so that they can wrest control from the aggressor, or so that they can rewrite the ending. And I think in some fashion, the way that I continued venturing further and further into the wild and deeper into these extreme realms, each time, while I might be putting myself at risk, I was seizing control and choosing danger with a sense of trust in my ability to navigate it and come home.
Word. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. I think that, you know, something that people may or may not know about you is that what would be called extreme sports is one of your passions, one of your hobbies. Before we go there, I'd love to hear your entrance into yoga, when you were curious about it, and how long before curiosity actually had you choosing a studio class, for example, or a gym, you know, something where there was an instructor and it was community. If you remember, I'm curious about that thing. I can't touch my toes or whatever you said. And how long it took before you got to the studio, and then if you can recount what occurred from there.
I do distinctly remember. there were a number of chapters in my relationship with yoga. The first was, I could just say, a flirtatious first date, in which in college I went to a couple of Bikram classes, literally two, sweated my ass off, left thinking that was a good workout and uncomfortable. I'm not sure I'm going back. So it was kind of a non-starter for me. Years later, after college, I had done a lot of traveling and for a stint came back to live in Denver with a friend in Capitol Hill. So I was only a couple blocks from the Capitol building and he had been going to yoga. This was the same friend that I had known from college with whom I had climbed a lot of mountains and we were always buddies in action and adventure. And so we usually riffed and referred, you know, new opportunities to one another. At this time, he said, "Dude, I've been going to this yoga studio just a couple blocks from here, and you can get a week of class for free. You should try it out. There's a ton of babes, and you're going to get shredded." And my mind at the time was like, single, young male, I like babes. Yes, I could stand to get shredded. I'll give it a try. So I went to the studio, took a number of classes, and did find myself, you know, quickly being tested.
Shredded.
Well, you know, it's like, certainly didn't see the results in a week, but I liked the challenge of it because it was very physical and kind of vinyasa style. Yes, there were beautiful women around, but what was most interesting was that there wasn't a strong spiritual side to it. That was the first time I'd learned of Shavasana. And when the class ended, the teacher said, you know, "All right, we've now concluded. Thank you for being with us. Namaste. If you'd like to stay and remain in Shavasana, you're welcome to. If you need to leave, you're free to go." And oftentimes I would opt, if I had that extra few minutes, to lay there because I savored the stillness after all the exertion. But it was hard because 80% of the class was getting up. They were jingling their car keys, door opening and closing. And so it wasn't a really grounded place for me to rest. However, when I would walk home from the studio, these short two blocks, usually in the mornings after a 6:30 a.m. class, I would feel the cool air on my body because I would wait to shower until I got home. And I would pause and notice the community fountain bubbling up from the ground. And I would perceive my environment more differently. And that two block walk became the meditative completion to my practice. And what I realized was that I enjoyed not only the physicality of the asana, but what was offered in the wake of it. And I wanted more of that. So once I got clear about that, I began to seek out other yoga studios that offered something more than just asana, and began to discover teachers that also offered dharma and the application of this work into my life off the mat as well, and holding space for the more meditative, contemplative side in breath work and in Shavasana at the end. And that's when I actually started to go much deeper into my understanding of what yoga could do for my life beyond trying to find a girlfriend and toning my abs.
Both.
Yeah.
Very legit North Stars for your yoga practice and the tip of the iceberg, right?
I'm unashamed to say that I was a total bro when I started.
Oh, absolutely. Myself included. My first draw was my mom saying, "Come to yoga with me." I said, "Okay." The instructor was a gorgeous blonde lady. I said, "I'll be back." I mean, it was very, very hormonally driven. But the beautiful thing about yoga practice and my experience of it, at least with the limb that we mostly practice here, asana in the States, is that it's a cause and effect. If you do these poses and begin to notice yourself in these poses, the effect is you feel something, you feel better. You feel stress relief, you feel what you felt when you came out.
Yep.
Because like you said, there may not have been a teacher that was necessarily directing you towards any kind of philosophical foundation, but just the act of doing the poses in community caused something. You can even not like it while you're doing it, and it will cause a result that's likely good for you.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I found that it was easy to gravitate to the pose, especially as an ego-driven younger man, arguably insecure as well. I gravitated naturally to the poses that I excelled at from the beginning. I went, oh, arm balance, I'm already strong. Or, you know, this kind of inversion, I'm courageous enough to give it a go. But when it came to flexibility or deep back bends or hip openers, even chair pose, love-hate relationship for sure.
For sure.
Because it was so confronting and I didn't like the vulnerability of being in community and sweating it out in something that was hard and that others might be excelling at. And so I'd really resist those type of experiences and only later realize how much they actually had to teach me that other poses did not, that came to me with ease.
Yeah. Well said. Absolutely. So from there, you kept climbing mountains, you kept doing other things. And how did your yoga practice or this dive into the deeper aspects of yourself? How does knowing yourself enhance the experience of doing extreme sports?
Yeah, well, if I could add a little addendum to this, I'd say that even as I started to get into yoga, I was still pretty restless at the time. And so I then pushed pause and I set out on a subsequent 5 years of travel to various countries of the world. And I might use asana as a self-stretching practice in, you know, during travel, but I wasn't really steeped in it. So it wasn't until a solid 7 years of wandering the world that I came back that yoga really started to make a difference, because I was very untethered and always chasing the next summit, you know, proverbially and sometimes literally, seeing what I could get up to in the next country or the next job opportunity I could pursue or the next skill set that I could learn. And after 7 years of that, found myself kind of fatiguing of the uncertainty of knowing where my next paycheck was going to come from, where I was going to live 6 months from now, and what it was going to take to build a new community. So I started to feel this pull back towards home. And when I did finally return to Denver and settle, I began attending classes at a tiny studio in Wash Park. And then I decided to do my teacher training there as a side gig for some extra lunch money. And it was both through my regular involvement in those classes and subsequently my yoga teacher training that I started to really peel back a lot of layers and understand how much this practice meant in my life beyond the asana and just the, you know, releasing tight hamstrings.
Give a shout out to that studio.
Karma Yoga.
Karma Yoga.
Yeah. Mm. Rest in peace. That the original one was right on Alameda and Franklin, a couple blocks north of the park. It has since been knocked down and turned into apartment buildings.
Great abodes for loving people.
That's right. And and it has relocated down to South Pearl Street. And yeah, so
beautiful new spot.
Yeah, many thanks. And what was special about that place was that's where I started to really get turned on to teachers, including Ellen Kay, who, among others, really taught from the heart, told personal stories, shared their vulnerabilities from the front of the room, and then allowed us all to process that together through breath and movement. And it was the Dharma talks, the storytelling, and that communal connection that had me want to dive a lot deeper and start to leverage yoga as a tool for understanding.
Yeah.
So as I've heard it said, yoga is not about mastering the postures. It's about using the postures to better understand and transform ourselves. Mm. And that was the alchemy that started taking place the further I went down this rabbit hole and used it as an opportunity for healing and self-development, et cetera. To bring it back to your question about how this ties into the world of extreme sports, in addition to mountaineering and snow sports and many of these other speed-driven pursuits that I like, I also had always fantasized about flying. So I ended up getting into skydiving, took the lessons, bought a parachute, became a full-fledged skydiver, and started racking up hundreds of jumps with a mission to fly a wingsuit, or what others know as a squirrel suit. Mm-hmm. So a big nylon suit with wings, fabric between the arms and legs, permitting me to fly instead of just fall like a rock. And what was fascinating was, for many people, that's the idea of jumping out of a plane once sounds terrifying. And I'm frequently written off as a thrill seeker, an adrenaline junkie, or a man with a death wish. And I would refute all three of those claims because, interestingly enough, when I pursue these sports, while there is inherent risk, while there is speed and intensity, because of my yoga practice, I'm actually able to enter into it with a grounded awareness of what's happening moment to moment, and arguably more clarity and ability to execute safely than if I didn't have a relationship to my body, to my breath, and to this moment to moment awareness of my surroundings. So though I'm flying a wingsuit at 120, 130 miles an hour through the clouds and banking corners and feel the G-forces, I often describe that as a moving meditation, just the same way that rock climbing is. And yoga has really served in so many of these environments for me where brute strength or gumption alone doesn't actually set someone up for success, because someone who's not body aware can easily get caught in the throes of an intense moment and start to literally white knuckle their way through it, hold their breath, clench their jaw, and underperform as a result of that stress and the cortisol pumping through them. However, I've been able to immerse myself in these fast-paced, inherently dangerous activities and enter into a flow state in which it seems that everything slows down and that I understand the subtle inputs of my hips and shoulders to navigate the wingsuit and to breathe through the experience and be present with my surroundings rather than white-knuckling my way through it and just trying to survive.
Mm. Well said. Yeah, I think that the same can be said for the yoga practice, for mindfulness, for meditation as a business person in a high-stakes negotiation for a legal team in an intense court case, for if you're driving a car in intense traffic. I think that what you're pointing at is that mindfulness serves across speed and intellectual intensity and relationships. And really, there's something there for me that I hear, which is mindfulness as a skill or as a practice is something that I get to take with me in my life. And one person might do extreme sports. One person might be a parent. And the practice of mindfulness, the practice of yoga is... it's some kind of your essence of who you be in whatever activity that you're participating in.
For me, it feels as though it's all almost granted the power to bend time.
Mm.
And what I mean by that is that when I become aware of how sensation feels in my body, of how my breath might become reactive rather than generative moment to moment, and how certain environmental stimuli might trigger me to cause a knee-jerk reaction. If I can bring awareness to that moment and to the physicality of it, then I'm suddenly granted agency again. So said otherwise, in between every stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is where your power lies.
Mm-hmm.
So over the years of this practice, the more and more I can become present to the space, it's that Matrix moment, like when the bullet's flying at Neo and he can slow and navigate out of its way as though bending time.
Right.
Because we learn to time warp and actually choose our response in that brief moment of awareness before we say something that we regret or act in a way that's going to require a lot of cleanup when we hadn't thought of it coming from the limbic fight, flight, or freeze response.
Yes, agreed. it is it appears like a superpower to the outside, and in a way it is. It is a superpower. You know, it is an evolution from the reactivity to the be able to be proactive in the middle of a second, in the space of a millisecond, which I imagine occurs in a flight suit on a regular basis, and also when, you know, being interviewed, as you're demonstrating right now, and being able to access yourself. And really, you know, what I experience from you is the ability to just get the thinking mind out of the way and let the flow of what there is to say come through you. I'd love to hear a bit about your burgeoning relationship and how intimacy and commitment in relationship has affected any parts of your life, really, from teaching yoga. Are you teaching yoga right now?
I am still currently, at Movement, Climbing, and Fitness.
Great.
Though I enjoyed a really great stint at Kindness as well.
Yeah.
So that
shout out to both those places.
Oh man, community is near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, absolutely. How has the practice of commitment and intimacy, how has that changed you as a teacher, as a leader, as an extreme athlete?
It might sound strange to hear that heart-opening postures have achieved that literal effect in my emotional life and relationships. I became really present over the years of practice, being fascinated with all forms of communication and particularly body language, the ways in which I was a container for my experience, and that moment to moment my body was reflecting and or communicating my thoughts or reactions to something, even if my words were saying otherwise. And so what I had realized after these years of travel, again, the Columbine shooting was devastating and impactful, and I suffered a number of other close losses in the years that followed, including a best friend to suicide, an uncle to suicide, a cousin who was like a little brother, just to an unexpected death a month after his wedding. And each time I suffered one of these blows, I felt like I was shutting down more and more, or traveling farther and farther away. You know, similar to leaving Littleton, heading, like running for the hills to get away, to escape the pain. Each time something else would bring me to my knees, I would find somewhere farther to travel or something else to engage with, so I didn't have to be with that.
Yeah.
But when in the relationship sense, what that looked like was being social and being very, I was an adaptable chameleon because I bounced through so many cities of the world and had to learn to make friends quickly. Also knowing that I was going to skip town 4 months later, and I never had to get that close to them or let them that close in. So the body language would be akin to crossing arms over my chest and staying a little bit guarded, maybe just with like my wine glass or beer mug. Like, hey, really, really enjoy conversation, but this is also still safe space.
Right.
Or guarded space, I should say. And my yoga teacher at the time, Katrina, my mentor during my yoga teacher training, called me out during YTT. And she said, Andrew, I have to be honest. There's something that's been sitting with me for a while. And it's on my heart to tell you. You have a way about you that's paradoxical, because with one hand, you invite them in to befriend you, to know you, to want to connect. And with the other, you stop them short of your heart and you don't actually allow access. So there was this contradiction between being kind and inviting and social to many people, but not totally availing myself. And I had that fear of being hurt again, whether it was by, you know, another girl or the potential loss or death of someone that I was just beginning to really establish a deep emotional connection to. And so in the practice and through the asana, there started to be a literal heart opening as I would dive into dancer pose or back bends or things like that, combined with big hip openers in pigeon and releasing this emotional energy from the junk drawers in my body. And so it started to shift slowly, almost imperceptibly at first. But I realized that there was value in letting people in more closely, and that the unintended consequence of building a wall around myself designed to protect was that it actually kept people from getting close to me when I did crave connection. So what it has made available for me over the years is risking that. I mean, I'm gesturing like peeling apart my rib cage and actually letting my heart be exposed to the weather and the changing elements of the world. You know, as my wife would sometimes say, at times I just feel like I'm naked on a battlefield. And so it's natural and human to want to guard that and keep what's precious close to us. But what I have found is through availing myself more through the physical asana and through the way that I teach, which is very Dharma driven. I took that nod from my favorite teachers. I always share something about my life and how this applies off of the mat. And the more and more that I'm willing to do that, the more and more I find students coming up to me afterward and saying, "Thank you. I don't know how, but you said exactly what I needed to hear today." Or that story that you told me a couple of years ago, that still stuck with me and I wanted you to know that. Mm-hmm. So I started to realize how much impact it was having by giving people access to the depths of me and not just the social media superficial understanding. So it has provided a level of intimacy that I didn't know before that in you know my marriage, in my social relationships, in the workplace, because I can actually sit and hold space for people and share candidly without the instinctive reaction to guard and, you know, cover arms over my chest the moment that I feel unsafe.
Yeah. A couple things showed up as you were speaking. One of my favorite authors, Paul Auster, has a book called New York Trilogy. And in one of the stories, he describes this man's relationship to the weather and to rain. And if he found himself caught in a New York downpour, he walked with his head up and his heart open and received the brunt of the rain on his whole face and body. And it transformed what could be something to try and avoid and cover up from and to protect from into this experience of actually being intimate with nature, being intimate with the feminine in that case.
Yeah.
And how beautiful it is to open your throat to something that you might have protected yourself from previously. And the other thing that occurred to me to ask is, can you remember what you felt was at risk if someone got in?
I think it was probably twofold. One was, I'd rather not get that close because there's a good chance that I could die any day now. And I know that that's going to cause harm, and vice versa. I don't know if this person's going to stick around, and I've already endured so much pain from losing those that I care about. I don't want to subject myself to this again. So as long as I keep an emotional distance from you, it's not going to hurt as much if you up and disappear, whether leaving the relationship, moving out of state, or God forbid, pass away. If I haven't tethered my heart directly to yours, I can more easily manage that separation if suddenly it disappears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what's at risk now? You're married. What's at risk for your heart today?
What's at risk for my heart is playing a bigger game and standing for more people. My wife is really clear about my commitment to her. We acknowledge our love for each other ad nauseum. You know, like, there's no There's no challenge.
My guess is add inspiration.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's really, thankfully we've also gone through a lot of personal development work together as well, which you're familiar with. And because of those, courageous conversations that were required early on in our relationship before saying I do, we've already unpacked the skeletons. We've aired our dirty laundry. We've had a lot of these conversations to get complete and fully see and be seen. Mm. So our relationship feels absolutely empowered and safe. So yeah. I'm so grateful for that, the ways in which we're able to communicate with one another and hold space for one another. And now the what's at risk now is stepping onto a bigger stage, not for the sake of an ego caress or being in the spotlight, but availing myself to a much larger audience and trying to hold space for healing and empowerment on a much bigger scale, knowing that many people still have a lot of wounds that have not yet been tended to, and those wounds can be projected outward. And so I have to, what's at risk is being so fully open and available, and also being mindful of what I allow into my space. Because as an empathic person, it's easy for me to take on the weight of the world and to feel alternating emotions of hope one day and then despair the next when I lament the state of the environment or politics and things like that. So if I didn't give a shit about it before, if I were closed off and just, you know, worried about
arms crossed on your chest.
Yeah, that's right. Brené Brown says that, you know, this kind of posture of arms crossed and whatever, that the body language of cool is an emotional straitjacket.
Mm.
As long as I'm bound like this, like I don't have to engage with anything because it doesn't matter to me.
I'm bulletproof.
If I don't care about it, then I'm not sensitive to it. I'm not vulnerable at all. But the risk now is that I've done so much of this work to allow myself to be open and to feel at much deeper levels than I ever did before. With that comes the acknowledgement of a lot of pain in the world. And sometimes that feeling of hopelessness that I, as one individual, can't do enough to fix it. So I can be burdened with the heaviness of my larger global awareness of the amount of suffering that's taking place and feeling incapable of rectifying it. And so that can be a really heavy burden, and that can also very much sap my energy, or the risk is feeling like if it's too big and I can't make a difference, like I'm just not going to bother, and almost shutting down under the sheer intimidation of the scope of the work that needs to be done.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, luckily you're not alone, you know, and more of us, people listening, me, Aubrey, your coworkers, we are spear holders on the line with you. And that's how it's going to get done is that we remember that we're not alone. Last question for you today, Andrew, is talk a little bit about kindness and the technology of the word and kind of how kindness as a concept and as a feeling and as a thought, how is that for you, and what does it mean to you, how does it show up for you?
Hmm. I'll say two things about that. One is I was really moved the first day and the first class that I taught for kindness. Mm. It was at the Cap Hill studio. And as the instructor, I would first station the desk, check students in, and then hold space in the class and teach. And there was a note written on the desk that said something to the effect of, kindness is not an economic exchange. And you might be able to restate this quote if you remember it.
I don't at the moment, but I'm sure it spoke to our pay what you can model.
Exactly. And I was so moved by that because at that class, a student showed up And she was a bit frail and appeared to be kind of recovering from some physical health challenges. And I welcomed her and she said, "Hey, I just, you know, thank you for hosting. And I'm just kind of managing right now, so I can only do so much." And I said, "Yeah, no problem." Assuming she was talking about her physical state. And then shortly after hanging up her coat, she placed $2 on the desk. And I understood what she was talking about was, "I can only afford this much right now." And in that transaction, I understood, oh, you can only do so much. I'm so happy to have you here. Like, grab yourself a mat and let's dive in. And so I was so moved by the opportunity to offer that, to share that, the magic of that practice with someone of limited means at the time. And so kindness for me, one, is this notion of not interacting with other people based on what you think you're going to get in exchange, economically or otherwise. But it's about how the you treat someone who has little to nothing to offer you in exchange. And so, you know, following that, kindness to me implies a return to tribalism and what it means to actually take care of our own. Because in life today, we live in these echo chambers and we're shouting inside of them about the other party, about those who disagree with us. And it feels so divisive and so toxic. And so while we might have our personal band, we say, "I'll take care of you, but screw those other guys," you know, whether it's the other football team, the other political party or otherwise, there's so much division. And so we carefully select how generous we're willing to be with other people, depending on whether we perceive them to be in our tribe or not. Do you agree with me? Do you look like me? Do you vote like me? If so, great. We're on the same team. I'll invite you to the dinner table. If not, I'm a little bit wary about how generous I'm willing to be with you. And so kindness for me is a sense of recognizing our race as a tribe sharing one home. And that means not sizing someone up based on appearance, political affiliation, gender, creed, or otherwise, but human to human in that moment saying, "What does this person need?" without any assumption of receiving something in return. Because in a tribe, it's in the tribe's best interest as a surviving social structure for everyone to look out for everyone else. In the event that an alpha starts hoarding all the food just to feed himself, the tribe will usually take it upon itself to excommunicate that person because they're actually not good for the whole. And so I think we're at a time right now where it's incumbent upon us to be good stewards of one another and of the land, because selfishness, greed, and actions just based on self-interest don't actually serve anyone. So kindness is being good to the whole tribe, no matter who you find inside of it.
Boom. If I could drop the mic, I would, but it's got a cord on it and everything. It'd be loud. Wow, Andrew, we got to get more people in front of you.
Love that.
I'm happy to be a part of your team, your prop up team, and I'm grateful that you took this time out of your mission driven life to be here with us and to share your eloquence. So well spoken, so clear. I've found myself tearing up multiple times in your presence today. And where can people spend time with you?
Yeah, so I'm currently the gym director of Movement, Climbing, and Fitness in the Rhino neighborhood in Denver. I also teach a couple yoga classes there, so they can move and breathe with me in that space, or just come play in the jungle gym of boulders. I also have launched another business on the side that includes workshops, keynotes, and coaching. And that is titled Fear Focus Freedom. So borrowing from this background of extreme sports and a long history of engaging in frightening pursuits, such as literally stepping out of an airplane or jumping off of a cliff to trust my parachute to open. I understand what resistance feels like, and I'm not inviting everyone to take the literal jump, but I know many others who are aspiring to birth something into this life, whether it's to lead a movement, to write a book, to launch a business, to be a public speaker, and they're stuck in the throes of not enoughness or the insecurity or what if I fail. And so I really take a lot of pleasure in guiding people through that process, their hero's journey, if you will, at the stage of peak resistance before they understand how powerful they are and willingly walk into the dragon's den and come out the other side bearing gifts. So I'm really committed to helping other people bring their vision to life so that I don't have to do it alone, but instead can prop up those others who are on big missions to make this world a better place and to take care of the tribe. So I can be found on Instagram at TheAndrewFraser, F-R-A-S-E-R, or via my website at fearfocusfreedom.com.
Salido, amigo, hermano.
Yeah,
que chévere. Bien, chévere. Okay, everybody out there in Kindness Collective world, thank you so much for tuning in. Absolute pleasure to have you here. Look forward to being with you again in the future now. Namaste.